Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. See PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, historic budget Tuesday night, Labor finally went where many of its supporters have wanted them to go for many years, taking away some of the benefits from negative gearing and paring back the capital gains tax discount and acting on trusts, partly designed to get more young people into housing. Now, there are two or three huge questions, of course, though, that remain. Do you like the changes, for a start? And do you like them enough to put the issue of broken promises to one side? And do you believe it will have a significant impact on housing availability for first home buyers? Tony, what was your first impression?
Well, the first thing that struck me is, you know, no Prime Minister wants to lie. I think there's documented evidence, and we might have a chat about the hawk years on that shortly. But by putting towards a package that they know the Greens will pass through the Senate, it means it's going to pass through pretty quickly. There will have to be amendments to it, but it's going to pass through pretty quickly, and you're not going to have the situation like in 2014 when Abbott broke some promises where he just bled and bled and bled and basically didn't get any of the changes through anyway. But it made me think about prime ministers that have lied and the consequences they've paid. If you work backwards, Abbott obviously broke those 2014 election promises and got shredded for it. Gillard, of course, said there'd never be a carbon tax under a government I lead. That haunted her throughout her term. Then you go back to Howard, as you pointed out the other week. He said never, ever a GST, but at least he then sought a mandate from the public in the 1998 election. Keating did LAW tax cuts. Now, that was a ageing government, so it had 13 years. So it was a big ask, but that shredded him as well. Hawke, I don't recall ever really breaking a fiscal promise, do you?
No, he promised that no child would live in poverty in 1990, but that wasn't a broken promise as such. It was a claim, and what he should have said, of course, was no child need live in poverty because you can't guarantee, no matter how much money you give them, that they won't live in poverty. But I can think of another one that goes to John Howard, and it doesn't go so much to the broken promise itself, but just how significant. Look, we've got a sorry history, no doubt about it, but how damaging are they? Remember John Howard in 1996, he'd only been elected about 3 months, and he broke a promise, and he talked about core and non-core promises. That was his excuse. So, well, there are core promises, there are non-core. And he was pilloried for that. But that was 3 months into his first term, and he served 11 years. So I think you can exaggerate that. It's interesting that you went to the broken promises right away and not the substance of the budget, and I think that's not unreasonable. A lot of people did, and a lot of the media did. But I think in the end it comes down to whether or not people think the end result was worth it. Just like with the last tax cuts, the Albanese government broke its promise over that, but that was an easy one because we're giving you more money than we told you we were going to give you. This is different because it goes to a policy position. You know, if the substance, if they embrace the changes, then that's at least a mitigation.
Do you think if he had gone to the last election saying we're going to make these changes to negative gearing and CGT, do you think he would have won 94 seats?
No, he wouldn't have won 94 seats, but he would have won the election. Of course, Shorten lost, but one of the lessons is you don't come at it from opposition. Just on that, Adrian Patera sent in an email, a couple of factors that are required here on these promises. A groundswell of support for such a change needs to be in place and quick implementation. So just to avoid the scare campaigns. And I would add to that, you do it from government, not from opposition. But you know, you talk about when it happened, and it's the promise was made before the last election. What seemed to have been overlooked in all of this is something happened in August last year. There was an economic roundtable, and They put it to Jim Chalmers, is everything on the table? And he said, yes, everything is on the table. So it was at that point, at that economic summit, that that promise no longer applied.
Mm.
Because he'd said that. Mm. He said it was now an open question. That hasn't played into the debate at this point, but it's worth recalling because it was kind of the writing was on the wall. I think given the level of support at that economic summit for these kind of changes, the writing was on the wall back then.
Yeah, I think the opposition are going to have really great campaign footage. You know, you've seen it already in the news breaks. Albanese snapping a journalist saying for the 50th time, no, we're not going to touch that. So he's going to have a problem navigating that. I think the other problem he's going to have as well, if the coalition are competent enough to execute it, is whenever he rules out a tax now, whether it be carbon tax or franking credits, which of course was another one of the policies in 2019 that the government, that the opposition had a bit of trouble with, it's going to be very hard for him to credibly rule those out.
But I think the same thing happened when he broke his promise on the taxation, that he wouldn't, that he promised that he would adopt the coalition's tax tables and then he didn't.
Mm.
And there were 3 or 4 days of absolute uproar in the media over it, and they said, this guy will never be trusted again. And then he went on 194 seats. So I think we can exaggerate the impact of this kind of thing because people understand in the end how the political system works, and it's quite often it's ugly.
Yeah, his polling did dip, though, you know, after that. I mean, he spent most of 2024 struggling against Peter Dutton.
Personally, he did, yeah.
Yep, and then Peter Dutton was leading on a preferred prime minister basis. But he's right. They're going to get it through quickly with the Greens. I think they're going to have to make some adjustments. I mean, one of the things that I've struck out at me was the arrangements with CGT. I don't think will survive in its entirety. It really should just be on investment properties. If you're going to start taxing shareholders as well as startups, that's a problem. So I'm sure the government will, you know, there's going to be a lot of bartering going on, a lot of lobbying from different organisations and so forth. But what we do find in a lot of our research is young people trying to get ahead, get a deposit for a house, have actually invested in shares as a way of making their money work harder so they can get to that deposit quicker. So I think there's a bit of an unintended consequence to penalise those people. And as well as, you know, if you've started up a business and remember a lot of these people that sell their businesses for quite a lot of money, they only give themselves a living wage or sometimes they have to dip into savings to make the business, you know, grow and reinvest and so forth. Whether they should be penalised with a capital gains tax I think is questionable as well. Maybe at a different rate, but you're going to find people in the innovation sector, you know, New Zealand, for example, has a much better arrangement, other Asian countries. So, yeah, if you're a young person with some software engineering ideas and so forth, you're probably going to look at other options as far as tax regimes.
I felt just anecdotally watching a lot of the feedback from the budget, that was the one area where I think in the government they should be just a little uncomfortable, was around the shares, because people make a reasonable argument around, you know, young people can buy $10,000 worth of shares and they hope it'll be $15,000 down the track. And that's how you kind of get started in terms of building a deposit. And it's not about the houses, it's about the shares. But more broadly on the whole concept, Ken Henry, who is a respected tax expert in this country, and he was pleased with it, disappointed that they didn't tax oil exports, but and that they didn't cut taxes for workers beyond that. Well, we'll get to that because the opposition has. But his argument was they kicked the door in. They're inside now, and that was the point, that they'd taken that finally after decades of thinking about it. They've taken a step towards fairness and equity.
I think they've obviously done some things from a supply side with housing, with negative gearing and so forth, but Chalmers has been very explicit in his language that Treasury modelling says it's just going to slow down the rate of house price increases. Now, that's a good thing. It's not going to. He's certainly not saying it's going to decrease the house prices.
And they won't say that because then everybody who owns a house, and it's the number one investment, they don't want to hear that.
Exactly. And it's unlikely it's going to anyway. But obviously, next best option is they're not increasing it 10% a year and making it even harder. The big problem with the budget, to Ken Henry's point, is there's nothing about the income tax relief. So I think there's almost universal agreement that we need to tax property differently and wealth differently. But for those young people, again, trying to get into the market, they need to have more of their own income. so that they can afford to deposit. And the budget didn't tackle any of that. The other thing that leapt out at me about the budget was they're saying that inflation will be 2.5% next year, which I find very hard to believe. And that means a lot of the figures then are all flowing off that CPI calculation. They're also talking about GDP going up to 2.5% when a lot of the markets are flagging, not unreasonably, that there could be a recession. So there's some heroic assumptions in the budget as well.
Well, Angus Taylor did go there with the taxation, and that's why I like that concept for the same reason that I like much of what the government's done, because they've just kicked the same door in, right? This kind of concept of finally doing something about bracket creep has been sitting around again for decades, and nobody's really moved on it. And I just like the idea that even if it can't happen, and maybe it's unaffordable because it's going to cost $20 billion and the return starts at about $5 a week and ends up at $20. So is it too expensive for the outcome? But at least they're showing that it's something that they will look at into the future, and I think it'll cause a reaction from the government.
My sense is Labor, another disappointment with the budget is, you know, it seemed like a Daniel Andrews budget as opposed to a Hawke Keating budget to me. And
but what do you mean by that?
Well, the Daniel Andrews budget is very much a 3-year or 4-year cycle. You know, what's step one, what's step two, what's step three. Right. So step one was, you know, the tough medicine, gaining more revenue and so forth. We've discussed before about gas tax, and I said it's inevitable. And if I was the industry, I'd be going, if I was working for the industry, I'd say you guys need to go to the government and use the leverage you've got right now with our security partners, with the fuel crisis, and negotiate a 10-year plan in terms of exploration and planning and permitting, as well as, you know, a more realistic taxation regime. Next year is an inevitability, in my opinion, that gas tax will be on the table on the budget. So there'll be another revenue raising measure for the government. And then year three, before the election, will be the income tax cuts. And I think they'll do a better offer to the electorate than what Angus has put on the table. And remember, Angus's announcement last night is for the next electoral cycle. So he's locked that in. It's going to be very hard for him to then backtrack and say, you know, we'll see their tax cuts and raise you another 5%, you know.
Yeah, so I thought when you were talking about Andrew's budget, you were talking about the hammer and sickle, you know, communist manifesto that the Telegraph portrayed this one as, but just totally ludicrous treatment of the whole thing. But beyond the tax cuts, in Angus Taylor's response, was the entitlements now for migrants in Australia, and they're taking those away. But it applies to permanent residents. These are people who have taken a commitment to spend the rest of their lives in Australia. They have been admitted as permanent residents. The one thing, catch in all of this, is they haven't committed to taking out citizenship. Now, Cosimaris pointed this out in a piece that he wrote about it, that the outlier in all of this is China and migrants from China. All of the other countries are open to hold dual citizenships. The Chinese cannot. And if they do, they potentially could lose property, investments, bank accounts, and the whole bit. So it's a huge issue to them. So while it might be attractive to the One Nation cheer squad, there are 1.4 million Australians who identify as Chinese migrants. That's a lot. And so putting apart the unfairness of it all, I would have thought the net result politically could be a real clanger for Angus Taylor on this one.
Yeah, Sarah Ferguson asked him that question after the budget and reply. He clearly did not look briefed on it, and you know, he muddled his way through it. And then the next morning, he sort of took out a mop and bucket and cleaned it all up a bit and said, "We're grandfathering that particular provision." I think strategically, though, they might have made an error in putting too much out there. I know there's a lot of pressure on him after Farah, but you don't get 8 headlines the next day. You just get one. And obviously, you know, the centrepiece of his response was the indexing tax rates. And that goes to a bit of a Liberal legacy strength that they need to leverage a lot more than they've been doing. So I don't know why he just didn't keep it at that instead of going down this other path, which obviously was a pitch to the One Nation faithful after Farah. But I thought that's something they could have rolled out later on in the cycle, and obviously sort of, you know, done a bit more research on exactly how it impacts various countries.
Yeah, it's something they might have to look at again, I think, because of the sheer number of people who could be affected by it. And even if it's grandfathered, there's still the prospect of more people coming.
Yeah.
And relatives and so on. And as we know, the Chinese live in marginal cities like so many other Australians do, and it might have an impact for them. Look, we'll take a break. We haven't yet got to the wash-up of the Farah by-election. Just before then, I do want to mention our recording next week. We go live from the Sydney Writers' Festival. It's on Thursday at Carriage Works in Sydney at 9 a.m. and it's a free event. All you need to do is turn up, grab a coffee, and join us in the very large foyer they have at Carriage Works. Should be a lot of fun. Back in a minute.